Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, a new edition of the award-winning book, Grandeur in Her Daughters, Florida's Women During the Civil War, has just been published. We'll talk with author Tracy Revels.
I actually had to put that piece of paper down and just go take a breather because I could not believe what I had just read.
We'll discuss the history of citrus in the state.
Henry Flagler and Henry Plant built railroads that provided citrus growers with ready access to northern markets. By 1894, growers shipped over 3 million boxes of fruit, an increase of 1 million boxes in 4 years.
And we'll visit the Florida Civil Rights Museum online. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Historian and author Tracy J. Revels had to dig a little deeper than previous researchers to find information for her award-winning book, Grandeur in Her Daughters, Florida's Women During the Civil War. While much has been written about the Civil War, the role of women is usually overlooked, and as Tracy Revels explains, the entire state of Florida is often ignored.
Yeah, if you go to big works on the Civil War, if Florida is mentioned, it's just one paragraph, which is really kind of sad for a Floridian. I know that Florida was not considered by a lot of people very important. In fact, there's a line from the Civil War where a northern newspaper calls Florida the smallest tadpole in the dirty cesspool of secession. And historians have been dismissing Florida ever since.
Florida had a few noteworthy instances of military presence in the state during the Civil War that are often overlooked. Even less studied than our military history is the social history of Florida in the Civil War. Tracy Revels.
When I began this project, I noticed that if the social history got mentioned at all of Florida, there was usually one name, one woman mentioned. And I began to think, was there only one woman in the entire state of Florida during the Civil War? That didn't make much sense to me. And I finally realized that the reason why Susan Bradford Epps is the only person, the only woman mentioned, is because she wrote a memoir about her life during the Civil War. But she wrote it when she was in her 70s. So I kept thinking, okay, this is an interesting document, but can I find other women? Where are the other women in the state?
While Revels was interested in Plantation Society women like Susan Bradford Epps, she also found documents relating the experiences of women from different social backgrounds and levels of education. Represented in Grandeur in Her Daughters are cracker women, pro-union women, and enslaved women.
The process was, thinking about that Epps is representative of maybe only 10% of the state, maybe. So I went deeply into archival work, into family records and letters, a lot of them that had never been used before in Florida. Also went the UDC, United Daughters of the Confederacy, asked their members around 1900 to write memoirs and to write reflections. So I was able to gather some of those. Also from secondary sources, other published articles, many of them in the Florida Historical Quarterly, about military units, about towns. Looking for enslaved women was probably the hardest because, of course, enslaved women aren't literate. They don't get to leave behind letters and diaries. So often you had to read what were the white women writing about their enslaved women? You kind of have to read it backwards and say, okay, here's something interesting. Enslaved women were actually resisting their enslavement at home. They weren't acting like the memoirs written 50 years after the war make them sound. It's a very different story. Of course, newspapers too are a very, very important source for this.
Using the diaries, essays, memoirs, and letters of a diverse group of women, Revels shares many interesting stories. One woman even followed her son to the front lines.
There are women who want to stick close to their sons and husbands. There are women who enter Florida during the war that we often don't think about that. But someone like Dr. Esther Hill Hawks, who is from up north, who comes with the Union Army during the war, tending to the Union soldiers and then teaching freed children here in Florida. So there are just amazing stories. There are amazing stories of Confederates, of Unionists, of enslaved women. And some of these women you're able to follow all the way through. So you sort of get to know them by the end of the book. And I tried as many as I could to tell the rest of their stories, that what happened to them after the war as well.
Tracy Revels says that some of the sources she found for Grandeur in Her Daughters showed only a rudimentary grasp of English grammar.
I like to tell my students, you haven't really lived until you try to read a Florida Cracker letter, which has very poor spelling and punctuation is optional. And the best way to really understand it is to finally just sit down with it and read it aloud. And I really think my own sort of Southern twang helped me in that I could tease out that what was going on in the letter that I have the long excerpt from is actually a father talking to his son about the romantic adventures of the son's friends back at home in Florida. Those letters are both a child, they're a challenge, but they're also delightful because they remind you of the humanity of the war. Dad can barely put a sentence together, but he still wants his son to know what the girls are up to back at home.
During her research into Florida's women during the Civil War, Revels had moments where she was stunned by what some women had to say.
I had a moment where I was reading Ellen Cole Long's diary, and she's writing about enslaved people, and she says at one point, oh, the Yankees are going to make us look so bad because we broke up families, but slaves are eternal children who don't care if you break up their families. And I actually had to put that piece of paper down and just go take a breather because I could not believe what I had just read. But those are indeed the moments you live for in our archives when you are shocked by something and you then need to process it and think about how it fits within your story. Obviously, when she wrote that in her diary, she wasn't intending for someone 150 years later to read it, but there you go.
What makes Ellen Cole Long's comments even more surprising is that, like her father, two-time territorial governor Richard Keith Cole, Ellen Cole Long was against Florida seceding from the Union and championed rights for African Americans after the war.
She's a good example of how I think a lot of women had divided hearts. They might have supported their husbands and sons who want to go run off to war, but at the same time, they may be thinking at home, this is really foolish. We're going to lose. This is foolish. People are going to die. And Ellen indeed goes back and forth. And so her diary is a very interesting artifact that you see her swing back and forth. And then, of course, later in her life, I think her racial attitudes changed. She developed more respect for Black people than she had in 1865 when she was a slave mistress. So, yes, those, again, I think why you study history is to connect with humanity and to see humanity at its low points and its high points and how it can evolve.
Tracy Revels has greatly expanded our understanding of Florida's women during the Civil War with her book Grandeur in Her Daughters, but she also hopes to inspire new generations of historians.
I do, because, you know, I don't think anyone ever writes a definitive history. There's always more to be discovered. There's always another group of letters or some newspapers or just a different interpretation. So what I hope, especially with reissuing this book, is that we get it into more young people's hands and that hopefully they'll be inspired to dig a little deeper, as the song says, and write their own histories of Florida women. And my great dream is that someday we'll have graduate students who go state by state in the Confederacy and in the Union, because neither the Confederacy nor the Union was a monolith. The experiences were not the same. Class, race, where you live makes a difference. And so I really hope people will go further in women's history and dig for those things.
A new edition of the award-winning book, Grandeur in Her Daughters, Florida's Women During the Civil War, has just been published. Author Tracy J. Revels also teaches history at Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find out about the upcoming Public History Forum in Orlando, May 15th through 17th. With great presentations, tours of historic sites, the annual awards luncheon, and more, it's an event not to be missed. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now from the Library of Florida History in Cocoa is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Florida's experience with citrus is long and complex. From its introduction by Spanish explorers to its key role in the state's economy, the history of citrus is one of freezes, citrus pests and diseases, and struggles to meet the challenges of shifting economies and incorporation of scientific and industrial changes.
That complex history is reflected in the title of Scott Husey's 2000 article, Freezes, Fights, and Fancy: The Formation of Agricultural Cooperatives in the Florida Citrus Industry. Husey argues that the traditional independence of the state's citrus producers collapsed in the mid-1930s when they, quote, finally ceded the need for a pan-Florida organization. A national history of collective organizations and new federal legislation provided the background for the establishment of the Florida Citrus Commission and the Florida Department of Citrus, FDOC. The combination of growers, packers, shippers, processors, marketers, bureaucrats, and politicians into a state government department became one of the nation's first state-sponsored organizations designed to support a single agricultural commodity, end quote. Today, the FDOC, funded through a self-imposed tax, supports the citrus industry through educational programs, scientific research, and promotional activities. Creating the organizations was fraught with challenges. Husey explains that oranges were traditionally a luxury item, but the actions of four people helped propel oranges from a rare treat to a healthy part of daily diet. Harriet Beecher Stowe's publication of Palmetto Leaves, quote, inspired Northerners with dreams of wealth to come to Florida to grow Florida gold. One of those Northerners, former diplomat Henry Sanford, bought a tract of land in Mellonville, established the eponymous town of Sanford, and established citrus groves and an experimental farm. As Husey notes, he also, quote, experimented, end quote, with the darker side of black and immigrant labor. Henry Flagler and Henry Plant built railroads that provided citrus growers with ready access to northern markets. By 1894, growers shipped over 3 million boxes of fruit, an increase of 1 million boxes in 4 years. Growers expanded their market by planting a variety of orange and grapefruit trees that extended the harvest season. Disaster struck in the winter of 1894-1895 when killing freezes destroyed the trees. Smaller growers abandoned their groves and returned north. Others stuck it out and moved further south to start over. But Florida's citrus production did not surpass that of California until 1946. The new Florida citrus belt extended from Ocala southwest to Bradenton and southeast to Fort Pierce. In the second Florida citrus boom, quote, "the image of the independent orange grower became ingrained in the identity of the state as orange groves dominated the landscape of citral Florida." As historian Gary Mormino observed, the orange tree was, quote, "so interwoven in the Florida dream that an agricultural commodity became a natural component of the Florida landscape," end quote. Orange trees dominated the landscape, orange blossoms perfumed the air, and fruit stands and packing houses dotted the highways. By 1919, Florida growers produced 6 million boxes of fruit annually. The appearance of the Mediterranean fruit fly, or medfly, in Orange County grapefruit in April 1929 changed everything. The medfly feeds on more than 250 host fruits, including citrus, apples, pears, peaches, and plums. One of agriculture's most destructive pests, it is treated by quarantine. In this case, the quarantine extended to 1,002 groves surrounding Orlando and was enforced by the National Guard. The affected groves represented nearly 80% of the state's crop. Eradication of the pest required the destruction of the trees. The impact on individual farmers was dramatic. As Husey explains, quote, "recognizing the medfly's threat to the industry, citrus growers reluctantly sacrificed their independence for industry preservation," end quote.
Connie, Florida citrus growers had created a successful cooperative in 1909 that operated under the Sealed Sweet label. What was the role of the cooperative as farmers moved toward a more robust organizational scheme?
The Florida Citrus Exchange continued until 1959, but it was not the only cooperative in the state. Local and regional cooperatives included Indian River Citrus League, Florida Canners Association, Florida Citrus Mutual, Florida Citrus Canners Cooperative, and the Committee of 50. This multitude of cooperatives compared unfavorably with the single California Fruit Growers Exchange, which spoke for all growers and marketed the fruit under the Sunkist label. Historically, cooperatives faced legal challenges as they were viewed as abridging the 1890 federal Sherman Antitrust Act and therefore subject to prosecution. In 1922, the Capra-Volstead Act, or Cooperative Marketing Act, corrected the problem. Despite some successes with citrus cooperatives, by 1933, many growers were seeking a government solution that would unite the various groups that spoke for Florida citrus. As John A. Snively, president of the Florida Citrus Exchange, predicted, only legislative action could accomplish that. In 1935, after years of, quote, "rollicking daredevil up and down acrobatics of an industry in complete conflict with itself," end quote, the Florida legislature created the Florida Citrus Commission, which was headquartered at Lakeland. Citrus codes regulated fruit standards for shipping, called for state industry advertising, initialed licensing and bond procedures, controlled color-adding applications, and instituted emergency price guarantees. As historian John Hopkins proclaimed, quote, "the citrus codes rang down the curtain of the citrus industry's formative years," end quote. It was not all smooth sailing for the new government agency. As Florida citrus production moved toward a new era with a focus on orange juice rather than table fruit, paired with the recognition of the importance of vitamin C in the diet and the ability to provide a frozen concentrate that approximated the taste of fresh squeezed orange juice, Florida citrus entered a new era. Husey concludes that, quote, the Florida Citrus Commission stabilized an industry constantly plagued by overproduction, underselling, and infighting through cooperation and an increased marketing presence. This cooperation paved the way for the phenomenal success that frozen orange juice concentrate brought.
And while the citrus industry in Florida is not as strong as it once was, it remains an important part of our economy and our history. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. A new virtual museum is presenting exhibits about Florida's civil rights era. Sebastian Garcia has more.
Delatri Jordan Hollinger is the founder and co-executive director of the Florida Civil Rights Museum. He's also the founder and president of the National Association for the Preservation of African American History and Culture. He's a fifth-generation Leon County resident. Jacqueline Yvonne Perkins is the co-executive director of the Florida Civil Rights Museum and the Robert and Turdy Perkins Foundation. I spoke with Delontre and Jacqueline about the Florida Civil Rights Museum, the nation's first born digital, entirely virtual civil rights museum. The museum was officially incorporated in 2021, but its conception emerged circa 2013 as a countermeasure to the many historic African American landmarks being demolished or gentrified in Leon County precisely, and in Florida more broadly.
One of the buildings that was on the chopping block at that time was the Firestone Building, which was also the historic Leon County Jail Building, which is where many of the most significant events took place during the Civil Rights Movement. And so I suggested to city, state, and national leaders at that time that Florida, particularly the capital city of Tallahassee, should have a statewide focused civil rights museum. One of the individuals who agreed with that was then United States Senator Bill Nelson. I also had many conversations at that time with members of Congress and members of the state cabinet. The Secretary of State at that time, Ken Detzner, actually sent a letter in addition to Senator Nelson encouraging that building's preservation. And so when the building was demolished in 2018, what did come out of that was the Civil Rights Memorial Plaza, but also the idea that there should be a statewide focused civil rights museum in Florida. And so in 2021, the Florida Civil Rights Museum was officially, formally incorporated with Ms. Jacqueline Perkins and myself as co-executive directors. Ms. Perkins took the mantle and really she developed the budget for an initial civil rights museum. She advocated for initial funding to be granted to the museum.
The lack of knowledge regarding the civil rights era in Florida further provided the impetus to create the museum.
In Tallahassee particularly, people seem to, when they talk about the civil rights movement or even at the height of the civil rights movement in Tallahassee, the only thing they talked about was the bus boycott. And we wanted them to know there's so much more. So many other people whose names have never been called. And so we wanted to make sure that we told other stories. And there are many, many more to tell. It's not about a bus boycott. That was an integral part of this process of advancing civil rights, just like voting rights. But we wanted people to understand that civil rights is not defined as a bus boycott.
The scarcity of funds partly explains why the Florida Civil Rights Museum was a born digital project and why it continues to be an exclusively virtual space. Nevertheless, Delontre and Jacqueline have maximized the advantages of a digital medium in that users can learn about history in ways not entirely possible in a traditional museum setting.
The exhibits are created with the purpose of providing a holistic view of the person. So it's not a traditional museum of course, but in the sense that you get more than just a paragraph on a placard. You get the opportunity to view several photographs of the individual, in some cases their newspaper articles. In other cases, with our personal perspective series that Ms. Perkins created, you get an opportunity to view a video of an individual family member speaking about them and their most significant accomplishments.
And I'll give an example, and I know it's not a problem to do this. Justice Joseph Hatchett's grandson actually put together a wonderful presentation on his grandfather before he passed. He interviewed him. He had photographs. He had videos. And he talked about him about every aspect of his life. And there's so many interesting things, not only just about his grandfather being a Supreme Court justice, but also the election that led up to that. And this was a Black man who was running against one of the most quote-unquote powerful and well-known individuals from a family in the state of Florida who founded Duval County. And Governor Askew asked another prominent individual in the state of Florida to serve as his campaign manager. And the campaign manager was saying, oh, he can't possibly win. But he won. And no one has won since then. So we're going to tell those stories and give people that additional perspective and have people talking about it rather than you reading about it. You'll hear that person. You'll see them moving. You'll see their reaction.
So it's multifaceted what you get with each and every single individual. You're able to really learn about this person in depth, and you can do it from anywhere in the world. It's certainly convenient, and it gives you an opportunity to learn a lot of information. For instance, the National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C., it might take you about 3 hours or more to walk through that museum. You can go through our museum on your computer screen at your leisure. You don't have to spend money on travel. You don't have to purchase a hotel room. So it has its advantages.
And I agree wholeheartedly with Delatry with that assessment. The advantage is that it's more attractive to young people. I know that the school systems can save money. They don't have to transport the students. The young people are used to being able to take their devices and navigate and kind of say, okay, I see that. I've read that.
Future plans to expand the museum and its influence include extending the focus from the Tallahassee/Leon County area to the entire state, creating new exhibits that feature historic landmarks and buildings during the civil rights era in Florida, and eventually having a physical location.
The Leon County Board of Commissioners initially provided a donation to the museum, and so that's why we're focused on Leon County at the moment. However, certainly we will be living up to our name of the Florida Civil Rights Museum and implementing exhibits throughout the year and in the years to come focused on other areas of the state. And also my hope is that in the coming years we will expand to an actual physical location.
Miss Jacqueline Perkins.
It feels comfortable. It feels like you're in a museum. It feels like you're walking through. You see these beautiful photographs that have almost looked, I mean, this 3D experience, and you see the furniture, and you're able to click on and then read the bios. I think that people will be very happy to see that.
To support the Florida Civil Rights Museum, a 501c nonprofit organization, please visit the Virtue Museum at www.floridacivilrightsmuseum.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.